Today's program was brought to you by Estes Public Relations. For more information, visit estespr.com.
Hi, this is Celia Kutcher, host of Animal Instinct, and you are listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hey, hey, you're listening to Eat Your Words on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Kathy Irway. It's the day before Halloween, so a lot of people are all dressed up in their spooky costumes today. Not me today. it's a weird weekend because Halloween is tomorrow and it's a Monday, so it's just all weekend long of Halloween. However, I'm looking forward to a long weekend, it's already underway, of cooking. And I'm really inspired by this new book. It is absolutely gorgeous. It's about Appalachian food culture and so much more. And the author, she's been a longtime food writer, and she's actually been writing about Appalachian food and Southern, Southern food and also music for the last 30 years or so. Her latest book is called Vittles. It is Ronnie Lundy. How are you?
I'm great. So nice to hear from you. Yes, and Halloween, pretty exciting, right?
Yeah, it's been just an epic long weekend of Halloweening.
I know, and it's hard when you look out to go, is this person in costume, or is that who they are all the time?
Yeah, I mean, so Ronnie, what are you, do you have any plans for Halloween, or do you try to cook anything spooky or appropriate? I don't know, roadkill? I'm just kidding. Anything?
Yeah, well, that's an interesting question that you're mm-hmm. asking, because I'm a part of a sort of new Appalachian tradition that goes back to an older one here. I live in the mountains of North Carolina, western North Carolina, mm-hmm. about 40 minutes and several lifestyles outside of Asheville. And my daughter and son-in-law and my grandson live in a small community about 20 minutes from the town that I live in. And in that community, the children, there's a guy who has a hay wagon who lives there. It's on a tractor, not mules, but all the children and their parents dress up. The kids ride in the hay wagon. They go around to about 10 houses. People say, if they're interested in distributing candy. And then we all go to a community center where we make various forms of chili and cornbread. And I always have to mark, I always proudly mark my cornbread as being gluten-free and no sugar in it. Mm-hmm. And we have a big meal together. And then there's a long bridge over the Hannah Branch Creek before you go into the community. It's a beautiful old stone bridge with wide balustrades on either side. And so this weekend, the whole community has been carving pumpkins into jack-o'-lanterns. And there are a lot of artists in the region. So after we all eat enough chili and cornbread to founder, we all go out and walk up and down the bridge and look at the artwork.
Oh, that sounds so lovely. I bet those are going to be impressive, too, if that's such a long tradition. You'd think that they try to outdo themselves each year, so that's really cool.
Yeah, it really is.
And you mentioned the cornbread. It's gluten-free. That's because it's simply the traditional method is cornmeal, which is no flour, right? So
Because it was a daily... It was a daily bread, you know. Mm-hmm. It's kind of funny because in my family and in a lot of Appalachian families are people who had Appalachian roots of my generation, mm-hmm. and I was born in 1949, and the previous generation. So your family referred to bread when your family said bread. They meant
cornbread. Wow. Oh, sorry. Go on.
When they meant store bread, they would say light bread.
Light bread. That's very accurate. Well, I think that's really emblematic of a sort of the pride in preserving the same foods and the same way it's made over time that you really explore in this book, which is really it's really fascinating. Actually, well, to me because I'm not from this area, so this is kind of exotic to me.
Right.
And it's really lovely that you kind of took it upon yourself to explore all the food traditions of the region right now and how they tie back to history and the culture of the region. And Ronnie, if you don't mind, I would love to read a little passage from the introduction because the writing is just so evocative and lovely.
Sure.
All right.
Sure.
So you mentioned that you had moved to the city to work. So I'll start from there. Like most who migrated in the many hillbilly diasporas brought up in the regional economic crashes of the 20th century, my parents continued to call Corbin up home and to take me there whenever they had the chance. My great aunts fostered those connections to riding up to Louisville on the L&N Railroad in the morning to take me back to spend a few days with them. We rode back in the evening, the train rolling through a velvet darkness that deepened as the landscape edged closer in around the tracks, rose higher to the sky. When we got to the house where my great aunts lived, where my mother had grown up, I could see a multitude of stars pouring down from the hilltops. The very sound of the night was different, deeper, full of cricket and frog peeps, not car engines and the all-night factory clang outside of our apartment in Louisville. When the sound of the train passing by across the creek broke through the deep velvet, it was not a rude interruption, but a reminder that I was surrounded by love. So this is a sort of introduction to the place that you remember so fondly in the country, in the mountains, that is. So,
right.
I love that, you know, talking about the Appalachian region, you know, we are immediately conjured with a landscape because it denotes obviously a mountain range. And,
right.
But you also note that we, you know, in our culture, and you had learned this after you'd sort of grown up and moved out and gone to college and stuff, that, you know, we tend to have these stereotypical opinions about this region and
right.
sort of caricature of hillbillies and so forth from television shows and whatnot. So how did that, you know, what inspired you to more fully expose and try to share the real culture?
Yes. Yes, and I realized that I was fortunate to have grown up in a family that was very loving.
Mm-hmm.
I grew up in the era. Mm-hmm. Where we discovered the term dysfunctional family, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And I realized that my parents, by and large, operated the safe house mm-hmm. for my friends and many people. And so I felt really privileged that I grew up in the culture that I grew up in, where there was such a strong sense of family and such love for children and love for place and continuance of place. And when I would tell people where I was from, it's funny because if you're from Kentucky, if you say you're from Kentucky and don't specify, you know, you get one of two stereotypes. People either think you're a hillbilly and look down and say, oh, but you're wearing shoes. Did you date your cousin? Blah, ha, ha, ha. Or they think that you grew up on a horse farm, which is pretty, a whole other stereotype. But I just knew how different my life and experience was, and I knew from the stories that my family told. I talked about the fact that you know, I come from a culture of storytelling and sitting around a table, and that's what happened as I was mm-hmm. growing up. We would sit around the table that my mother filled with this amazing food, and my father and then my cousins and aunts and uncles, and everybody would tell stories. But my father particularly was a wonderful narrator mm-hmm. of true stories of life. And I knew that the reality was so different. And so I wanted to find ways to convey that to mm-hmm. people. And music became one of those ways. And in the late 1970s and early 1980s, when I first started writing professionally, mm-hmm. Bluegrass music was going through this surge of popularity and also a trans a transition mm-hmm. as a lot of younger artists came in and started mining the territories that it had always been connected to, of jazz and rock and roll, but it was more out there and more obvious. And I got to write a lot about that. I got to explore other cultures and understand my culture mm-hmm. in that way. I worked a lot with younger Cajun musicians who were in my age group, who would talk to me about their very similar experience in coming from a region of the country about which there were assumptions made, and mm-hmm. and based on those assumptions, the region had been exploited,
yeah.
and how they found in their music and that work a voice. And then I started to write about food. And I discovered that that was even more powerful, because when we look at food waves in America, we start to hear the stories. We can see a history that has actually not been recorded, the domestic history of yeah. the region, and the history of people, Appalachians among them, as I mentioned, the Cajun culture and the Creole culture of Louisiana, black culture, the contributions of African Americans. As you start to follow the threads back of, well, this is what we're eating here that we don't eat somewhere else. Why are we eating it? What mm-hmm. are we doing? Then we get this fuller picture. And when you look in the short version for Appalachia is when you look at the processes of seed saving, the in-depth understanding of the land and the climate and how much sun you have and don't have and where to plant because of that. When you look at the terrain that people had to work, which is often almost vertical
mm-hmm.
And filled with rocks, but also filled with tremendous resources. You know, I talk about how we fenced in the homestead, but you allowed your pigs mm-hmm. And other livestock to roam the forest because of all this incredible mast and food. And, you know, so there's a deep wisdom there. And there's also, and then when you talk about how we put up food and had food to sustain us through the deep winters that differentiate Southern Appalachian food from the rest of Southern food.
Yeah.
But it also indicates how hard people work. And it starts to bust apart these mythologies that Appalachians are inherently lazy, or that we're stupid, or that we don't know how and don't deserve to have our own land and take
yeah.
care of it.
I mean, yeah. gosh, I mean, what better incentive, you know, to sort of reclaim the culture and re-embrace it than, you know, something like these stereotypes. And it
yeah.
seems that this is happening in food with chefs too now. So sort of
yes.
paying homage to their roots, literally sometimes.
Yes, and, exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah, to the roots and branches. There's people like Travis Milton who has received some very strong attention, and we connected a couple of years ago and had this kind of emotional connection, because he had told me that a book that I had written 25 years ago, Shucked Beans, Stack Cakes, and Honest Fried Chicken, had been instrumental
wow.
in returning him to his roots. And Sean Brock and I had this same conversation. And then what they are doing, putting on the table, is like this expression of everything that's wonderful about the food. And once you taste it, I mean, you know, that's the great thing about food as mm-hmm. a means of communication, because it doesn't, you know, it's not just like writing that it's in your head,
mm-hmm.
but you taste this
yeah.
and it becomes a part of you. And, you know, one of the things that I like to say, Shelley Cooper, a young woman in Tennessee is, she's at Dancing Bear Lodge in the Smoky Mountains, and she's doing this work also based on her experiences with her at her grandparents' home place in the mountains of North Carolina when she was growing up. And one of the things that we have talked about is that these things have survived. Like chuck beans is mm-hmm. this process of drying the whole green bean, the green pod and the beans in it. You sew them up on string and you hang them and you dry them and you eat them in winter. And that was a way to survive the winter. That was a source of deep protein in wow. the winter when you weren't able to hunt, you know, when you might not have, when you might be running low
snack.
On the pig.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
Fermenting corn and green beans along with cabbage, which is another tradition of the Appalachian Mountains. These traditions have survived not just because they're interesting in an intellectual sense, but mm-hmm. they survive because they taste so mm-hmm. good.
Right.
They have just so much, I call it Appalachian umami.
Mm.
It really is a distinguishing factor of the foods here, that there is a deepness and a resonance in many of the emblematic foods. And they survived because we wanted to keep eating them. We didn't have to keep drying beans and mm-hmm. fermenting food and drying apples and making snack cakes.
Oh, I love
because that.
Because
that was all we had. It was because we loved it. And now we're getting this opportunity to actually share that with other people. It's a very exciting time.
And not just only survive, but thrive and sort of be,
yeah.
as you show in this book, reimagined in wonderful, different, interesting juxtapositions. I don't know. I think that, and we're seeing that with chefs too. So I think that, yeah, it's really an exciting time that you've captured in this book. It's definitely like a sort of moving target or evolving cuisine, even as
Hopefully
we speak,
sure
that
is.
You've captured. Yeah, at this wonderful sort of moment in time. I want to talk more about some of the themes throughout Appalachian cooking, since we're talking in such broad strokes, and because you arrange the book in such interesting chapters. So, but first we're going to cut to a quick little commercial interlude, and we'll be right back to chat more.
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
Today's program was brought to you by Estes Public Relations. Navigating the world of media can be tough. Lucky for you, it's our specialty. At Estes Public Relations, we specialize in media relations and marketing for the culinary, spirits, and travel industries. Our clients, including award-winning chefs, four-star hotels, and artisanal food products and innovative beverage brands, have been featured in media outlets nationwide. Each member of our PR team brings a unique talent to our firm, from TV training, creative writing, and digital marketing, to recipe editing, graphic design, and spirits education. In a market crowded with competition, we can help your message stand out by connecting with our long-standing relationships with industry influencers and journalists at top print, TV, radio, and online outlets to tell your story. Where can Estes Public Relations take you? For more information, visit estespr.com.
All right, we're back chatting with Ronnie Lundy, whose new book is called Vittles. So, Ronnie, I see a lot of cookbooks come my way, and I got to say,
right.
I really commend your really interesting and thoughtful chapter breakdown. I'd love to hear what went into that, but I'm just going to share for a moment. So the first section is roots and seeds, messing with greens and vegetables, and then there's salt of the earth, salty dogs, chili buns, and slaw dogs. Then the next section is all about corn, and then beans, and then Appalachia, so apples, then preserving, husbandry, and Appalachian spring. So let's unpack that a little bit. So we got corn, beans, apples, animal husbandry. Are these like sort of the how did you choose, like, are these like definitive or defining or prevailing
yeah.
categories?
I try to avoid the word definitive.
Yeah, I know.
because I always feel like I am tapping into something, but certainly not exhausting it. But these were, so I think when I first set out to write the proposal for this book, and I should mention it took me 6 years.
Right, because you did so much travel to explore these makers throughout.
Well, I mean, it took me 6 years to find the publisher, to find the editor who understood the book.
Oh, my goodness.
So, and part of it, you know, part of it, a little bit of it was this unusual concept of the chapters.
Right.
You know, it was like, are we talking about specific foods?
I'm sure,
was
a daring
move. Are we talking
move.
About cultural traits or whatever? But when I hooked up with Francis Lamb at Clarkson Potter, who is my editor, and they are my publisher and have done such an extraordinary job with this book, he was willing to allow me to work a little bit outside of the framework. And what I wanted to do was to choose certain emblematic foods that have something deep to say about the region. In other words, corn, you can talk about corn in almost any part of the United States and tap into the history. But in Appalachia, corn continues, heritage corn and traditional corn and traditional cornbread continue to be defining aspects of the table. Okay. Even to this day. And so, and then of course, corn liquor, obviously, don't have to say that has been a defining part of the culture, but there are so many aspects of, moonshining and making liquor that are not explored, that talk about community and also about economy. So there were these specific areas, that had to do with Appalachian food in a way that they, or specific foods that had to do with Appalachian in a way they didn't do with other places. Our particular love for beans, Southerners love beans and field peas in a way that the rest of the United States does not. And we have such a diversity here. But in the Appalachians, it almost becomes spiritual. It becomes almost religious. And so those were subjects, but I also wanted to talk about processes.
Yes.
I wanted to talk about things like the preservation of foods. And I mentioned when you look at the Appalachian larder in broad terms, the corn, the beans, the vegetables from the garden, pork as the centerpiece of meat and also as a seasoning, you realize that you're looking at the southern spectrum there. But when you look closer at Appalachia, you discover that because of our latitude, our altitude, and the severity of our topography, and by that what I mean is that we're not only high up and we're not only in a colder region than the deeper south, but we get less sunlight on our planting areas. Our planting areas are smaller, and we get less sunlight, so we have shorter growing seasons. We tend not to have the multiple growing seasons that you have in the south, in the deeper south. And so winter became a major part of our vocabulary, the storage of food, the preservation of foods, and certain specific foods. That chapter on Appalachia, you can grow apples farther in the south, but really great apples require a crisping of cold weather.
Yeah.
And we live in a region, there were somewhere between 1,000 to 1,600 varieties of apples here.
Wow.
Some for eating, many of them for making cider. And apples were a major cash crop for Appalachian farmers as well, as was meat, as were certain foods, because in the antebellum South, and you know, while there was still the plantation South, plantation owners did not want to turn over any of their valuable cash crop land to grazing.
Okay.
Cattle or pigs or are, and they couldn't raise apples, et cetera. So they would buy from the Appalachian South. That's why we have the Drover's Road going right through the Appalachian South, connecting Kentucky and Tennessee and North Carolina to South Carolina and deeper into the South where meat came down.
Wow. So I love how, you know, the chapter, it's not called Meats and Poultry, but it's called Husbandry. So you really take us through the past and the present of animal production and sometimes coexisting, you know, at the very same time and place with backyard, you know, keeping hogs, for instance, and small producers as well, which are still very much thriving in the region. And it's just a great section. And I think that each one, I should point out, you highlight certain different makers and producers. So that's a really great sort of moment in time, a snapshot of who's moving and shaking in this scene. So.
You know, if I can interrupt for a second, too, there's a literal snapshot. In that particular chapter, there's a couple that I talk about toward the end, Diane and Jim Johnson, who have Cloudcrest Farm in Rossville, Georgia. And I spent a day with them, and it was just such a beautiful experience, spending a day with them and their animals. And I mean, they are, yes, they are raising animals for slaughter. They are connected to a small butcher shop in Chattanooga, Main Street Meats, and that is where their critters go. But their relationship with the animals was just so so respectful and mutual and compassionate. I know that's probably an odd word for people to hear. And I wanted to try to capture that in writing the story. But what I was most thrilled about was that when Johnny Autry, the photographer who does these amazing photos in this book, and his wife, Charlotte Autry, is the food stylist, and I feel so fortunate to have connected to them. But Johnny went down and took photos at Jim and Diane's at Cloudcrest. And there's this beautiful photo that opens that chapter, and it's just of the back of a hog with Jim's hand on it.
It's so
and
cute.
I think that photo tells everything I wanted to tell about the difference between small scale, mutually connected husbandry, as opposed to the kind of giant industrial production of meat that
this pig, just for those who can't see it, really, it strikes me, the photo strikes me as like, this is a pet. That's just like the first thought I had in my head. He's enjoying a little shower. He looks very content. Glancing through it, I thought it was a dog for a second.
Yeah.
So that's
I mean, there's a practicality. You know, both Jim and Diane have a practicality about what they're doing too. You know, it's kind of it struck me deeply that you know, we have the luxury in our contemporary society, we also have a luxury of choosing what foods we will eat, not just out of their availability and our taste, but also, you know, to fulfill certain ethical ideas that we have. And that was not a part of the pioneer experience. That's not a part of, and to some extent, it's not a part of sustainable experience. When you really look at how, you know, the complex systems of a small-scale farm, animals play a part in it, and they're not pets, but they are deeply respected for what they bring to that story. And that was part of what I experienced with Jim and Diane.
And it's a wonderful, really an article. I mean, and this whole book, that's what makes this whole book so special is that you weave together several different current day, you know, well-researched pieces of journalism to create this tapestry that tells a bigger story. Perhaps not the whole story. Maybe we'll hear more from you yet to come, hopefully.
Apart from other people, too. There are some wonderful mm-hmm. people working in this region. My daughter, who's in her 30s and so has observed my whole career, said two things when the page proofs came in, and they mm-hmm. were black and white.
Yeah.
The first thing she said flipping through is, I can't believe how Charlotte Autry makes such simple food look so incredibly beautiful. And then the second thing she said was, I can't believe how much they let you write.
Oh, yes. That's what I got to have to say also. And I know that you mentioned you're a fan of the National Geographic cookbooks and sort of wanted to do something more like that.
Yeah, the Time Life series.
Right. Sorry. The Time Life series, which is one of my favorites as well. So I definitely can see that throughout. And it's hard to do that these days. So well done.
Yeah.
Good job fighting whatever powers that be order to do that.
Yeah. I'm very grateful because mm-hmm. part of that 6-year process of having a proposal out there was also finding people who were interested but didn't grasp the idea.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
one of the ways I illustrate that was an editor that I had a conversation with who I really liked, and we were, you know, having a great conversation until she asked me if we could drop Appalachia from the subtitle because of the connotations with poverty, and I just thought, yeah, we're not getting this completely here. You know, we're this because we can't not tell the whole story. You can't the designer for the book, you know, there's always this process where mm-hmm. you send in your pictures and your designer can come back and say, oh, no, can we have more gingham, you know, or mm-hmm. whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And we were holding our breath. And Stephanie Huntwerk, who was the designer for the book, wrote back and said, I'm so grateful how in both text and pictures you understand the importance of Sado in telling the story of the Appalachians.
Right.
And then she said she was from West Virginia. And so, I don't know who the powers that be are that got this book in the right hands, but boy, did it ever.
Absolutely. And so congratulations. I can't wait to share this with more folks. It's really much, much more than a cookbook. But if I must leave on one note, though, to anyone who is a little hungry, there's one recipe that I'm totally going to make very soon. Roasted root vegetable salad with bacon and orange sorghum vinegar. It just looks so beautiful.
Yeah.
Perfect for
fall. Oh, my God, it's so delicious,
Let's do this now.
make a good skillet of cornbread to go with it,
I will try, and I'll try to share on Instagram and tag you.
All right.
Well, thank you so much, Ronnie. It was wonderful having you.
Well, thank you. This was a wonderful interview. I really appreciated your questions.
Absolutely. All right. And thanks, everyone at Heritage. We'll see you next week on Eat Your Words.
Oh, I like the way you do. Whoa, the way you took it so slow.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.